excited about my talk. Have background. I'll talk about some GFS features.
So I'll talk a bit about the features, some of the locking stuff. The core of GFS is, as Ted pointed out or talked about, GFS has multiple machines accessing a central disk, and they're sharing it. And the key to doing that is locking. The machines acquire locks on different parts of files to let them to work without corrupting the disk and stopping on each other's work. One of our new features, we're doing journaling. In order to make GFS work so that machines can die and the cluster can keep on going, we had to add journaling. I have a bit about performance if we have time and some future work. So GFS is a shared disk file system. So as Ted talked about a little bit, GFS uses what's called a SAN, a storage area network. So one type of storage area network is fiber channel. Fiber channel is a gigabit network. You can do SCSI and IP and a bunch of other protocols over the fiber at the same time. The thing we like about it is each machine sees the disks as if they were local. So you get fast access, you get big bandwidth or good bandwidth, and good availability, and many machines can talk to the disk at the same time. Like I was saying, there needs to be a method of synchronization. So the machines need to cooperate in order to share these set of disks. So there are a couple ways of doing this. There's a third-party transfer, which is an asymmetric approach, and then there's the approach we're taking, which is a symmetric approach. So let me show you pictures of that. Asymmetric. The machines share disks that only contain data. So you have a bunch of machines connected to a SAN, and they can talk to these disks that hold data. There's one special machine called the metadata server, and it has its own set of private disks that contain the metadata, where the data is out on those shared disks. So every time a machine wants to do a create or a make dir or even read a file, it talks to the metadata server, and the metadata server says, hey, your data is on this disk at this block address. And then that machine can then use the fiber channel to go out and get the disk or get the data. This is kind of similar to a traditional distributed file system. It's like NFS. There's one server that's in charge of all the other machines. The only real difference is the way that the data is transported. Instead of NFS, the server sending the data out over the network, the server just tells you where the data is, and then you go get the data. You go get the data you want. There are a bunch of different examples of this. SGI has a product called CXFS, and a bunch of others. But we won't decide to do something different. We're doing a symmetric file system. So the difference here is that the machines share disks that contain both data and metadata. The metadata is managed by each machine as it's accessed. And there's a locking mechanism that's somewhere out in the SAN that the machines acquire those locks in order to protect their metadata operations as they read and write from the disk. A symmetric shared disk file system is very similar to a local file system. The only real difference is that it knows when to take out these global locks that protect the data that it's modifying. So GFS is the type of this file system. There are the VAX cluster, which is basically the granddaddy of all clusters, used a file system that was symmetric like this. And DEC has also made another one called Frangipani that is similar. Which brings us to the global file system. So it's a symmetric shared disk file system. It's open source. We started this. Basically, our group at the University of Minnesota was a big numerical simulation group. So we were focused on really big data and big data sets. And one of the things we needed to do was make all the pointers and everything 64-bit, so we can support very, very large file systems, very, very large files. We started out with IRIX. We didn't like IRIX. It wasn't open source. We had to spend too many long nights disassembling the buffer cache code, and it was just horrible. So we finally switched to Linux, and we've been much happier. And we kind of kept the goal of making it portable. So we'd like to get this to work on FreeBSD and some of the other open operating systems as well. So there are three basic parts to GFS. There's a network storage pool, which is basically a volume manager for a SAN. And we've been working with Heinz Smalshagen from who's written the Linux LVM, and we're trying to integrate with that as well. There's the file system itself, and then there are these locking modules that let GFS plug into as many different forms of locking as we can. One of our main goals of GFS is to make it as modular as possible. So you can plug in whatever operating system you want, whatever locking you want, whatever type of data transport. So we're happy with Fibre Channel. Shared SCSI works. Network lock devices work. Anything that you can share a data device between two machines, we're happy to work with. So a little bit of background. One of the things that we've been doing is we started out with a very hardware-based approach. We wanted to make, we're from Minnesota, and Seagate technology is right next door. So we thought a good place for these global locks would be to put them on the disks themselves. What that basically means is that instead of, or whenever you want a lock, you talk to the disk that has that data on it, and you can acquire a lock there. And the drives are very fast, and you can get your locks very quickly. And so we've implemented a SCSI command, basically, that you can get drives with this command, and you acquire locks that way. So we started out with one version of it called device locks, where these locks are on the SCSI device. They have a bunch of features. They're advisory, they're reader-writer. One important thing is they're leased. So you have to, when you acquire the lock, you have to keep on heartbeating the drive. And when you fail to heartbeat the drive decides you're dead. And it lets the other machines in the cluster know that, hey, this guy's dead, so that they can clean up after you died. So this worked. We got this working. The big problem was that every time we needed a little change, all the drive vendors had to change with us. And it was kind of a lot of overhead to do this. And one of our improvements, we've just started this new memory export thing. So basically, the drive doesn't know their locks. The drive just exports a bunch of buffers of memory that we change with this load lock store conditional command. And basically, it lets us do whatever locking interface we want using these drives and just using the drives and the RAID arrays as a shared memory location. So it gives us a lot more flexibility. So talking a bit right now, the big part about GFS is basically cluster infrastructure. You need to have this locking that's coherent. And in order to do it in software, it's actually a lot of work. Stephen Tweedy, Peter Brom, and some others are working on a cluster infrastructure for Linux. That's a couple years out right now. And we want to get GFS working now. So the approach we're talking about right now is mostly a hardware approach. So to get GFS to work and have full availability, you want dual connections between your CPUs and your RAID arrays, and fiber channel switches in the middle. You can have a bunch of them connected together so that basically any one part in this system can go away and you still have full connectivity. Okay, I'll talk a bit about Pool. Pool is just a volume manager for SANs. So it combines multiple disks together into one big disk, like any volume manager would, so that you can have multiple RAID arrays out there, and GFS just sees one big array of blocks. Also, since there are locks on the drives, it does the same thing with locks. So there may be multiple RAID arrays out there, each with their own set of locks. Pool glues them together into one big lock space that GFS sees. The other big problem, some of you guys probably know this already about SCSI, is that basically the way SCSI is defined is you identify disks by how they're connected to your machine. You know it's SCSI ID 0, 1, 5, or whatever, and that's how you talk to your disk. But in a fiber channel network, if you add another disk to the fabric that's way in another room, that can kind of change the SCSI ID of that disk. So what Pool does is it identifies disks by their contents, not by their names or how they're connected. And basically, it solves this big problem with storage area networks that you don't know what disk is yours and what disk is somebody else's. So a pool is made up of subpools of devices with similar characteristics. So we have a picture. There are a bunch of GFS clients connected to a storage area network. And there are a bunch of subpools in this pool, and each is made of a different type of device. So the idea is that you can have maybe a solid-state disks. So just RAM in a disk that you write all your metadata to. And that's very fast and low latency, so you want your metadata to be that way. But there may be also a big RAID arrays where you actually store most of the data. So that because these subpools have different characteristics, GFS, we're working on making GFS smart enough to pick where it stores data and hopefully optimize things. So I'll talk about a lot more about the file system. So we're aiming for a high-performance file system with, or local file system with inter-machine locking. So we've optimized it. We wrote it from the ground up for this network-attached storage. But you can also, there's a lock module that just provides dummy locks. So you can actually run GFS as a local file system, and it works pretty well. So a bit about the GFS layout. There's a super block, and the thing I'll talk most about is resource groups. So resource groups are mini file systems. Ted showed a picture of this. Basically, there's a bunch of bitmaps for allocation and inodes and blocks and stuff. So basically, resource groups let you have many allocations or deallocations of data happening in the file system at the same time. So picture that. So you have a bunch of subpools, each with a certain number of resource groups in them, and files. You don't need to set how many inodes. Oh, they just go out. Okay. So we have dynamic inodes. Whenever GFS needs a new inode and there aren't any left, it just picks blocks and and makes them inodes. So your number of inodes grow as your file system grows. So we have our metadata structure for our files it can be very big, so we can support very big files. We have platform-independent metadata so that we can do, very often have alphas and PCs sharing the same file system at the same time. Theoretically, you can do any other type of machine you want. We have extendable hashing directories. Ted was talking about B-tree directories. Extendable hashing is somewhat similar. It lets us have very big directories. One important thing for us is we use the buffer cache. So we can do full read and write caching, which is something we couldn't do. And then we have cross-platform support. Let me talk a little bit more about some of these. So there are no pre-allocated inode tables. Whenever you need a new inode, you allocate a block. Each inode lives in its own block, so you can have as many inodes as there are blocks in the file system. Inode numbers are just disk addresses. That makes things simpler. There's no lookup table that most file systems have. So the idea is that we have this inode that lives in takes up a whole block. If the data size is small enough to fit in the extra space in the block, we put the data there. So we can have fairly efficient small files where if your file data is small enough to fit in that stuffy area, you don't have any additional read to find your data. And if the data is too big, the data gets moved out of the stuffy area and pointers are used, like Ted was showing. To point to data blocks that have the data in them. So we took great care to do everything in 64 bits, so you can have very large file systems, very large files. This is going to be more and more important as basically disks get bigger. So a picture of this. We have a flat metadata structure, so for a small file, you may only have direct pointers. For the smallest file, the data is stuffed, like I said, right? And for a bigger file, you have all your pointers in your inode point directly to data. And as the file grows, the height of this tree grows. So basically, the tree goes as high as it needs to be to support the file. So we can have very big files. Platform-independent metadata, we handle endiness issues, structure packing issues, everything like that. So our goal is to make it so that any operating system or any architecture for Linux can share the same file system. Fast directories. So small directories are stuffed in the inode just like normal file data is. Larger directories use a technique called extendable hashing. Basically, you take the file name, you hash it into a 32-bit number, and you use that that number as an index into a hash table. And the what you get out of that hash table is a pointer to a block that the directory that you're looking for. So it now okay the trick is that basically the hash table grows as the directory grows. So you can get to any entry in your directory very, very quickly. So I regularly, as one of my tasks, I create million entry directories. It takes only about 2 hours, whereas compared to like EXT2, I usually get bored after 200 entries or 200,000 entries. So it's a bit faster than B-trees, but it's a bit more space hungry. I think this is a good trade-off. Disk space is growing a lot faster than latency is. So it's okay if your directory takes a little bit more space as long as it's faster. Okay, so another thing we do is we use so when we first started out, we wanted to make GFS very synchronous. One of the hard parts about GFS is the caching. So if you cache data and somebody else changes the data on the disk, you want to make sure you don't use that stale data that you had cached. So when we first started out, we didn't do any caching at all. We were expecting like the RAID array that we're using that has a lot of RAM on it to make up for that. And it turns out that performance really sucked. So one of the big things we did about last year was adding caching. So we added a couple fields to the buffer structure in Linux. And that lets us keep track of buffers. So we know what buffers correspond to what locks. So when we before we release a lock, we go through that list and we look for buffers that haven't been written to the disk yet. And when we find them, we write them to the disk. When we acquire the lock again, we know to go through none of those buffers are used because we know that data is stale. So basically, the long and the short of it is that we can do both read and write caching, and our performance is very similar to a local file system. Okay, some architecture abstraction. Like I said, we want to have GFS work on multiple operating systems, multiple architectures and everything. So we're using pretty much a Linux model of this. There's a big directory of common code, then there are subdirectories for each architecture. And that lets us have the common code that does everything and then specialized code that handles each operating system. So we have two layers. There's the top layer, which interfaces with the VFS, and then there's a bottom layer that does things like the buffer cache and memory allocation. And basically, it's the stuff that GFS requires of the operating system. So we've started a FreeBSD port, and so we're pretty confident that this stuff will work. So a bit about locking, or a lot about locking. Locking is broken into a bunch of layers. So there's one that's called the glock layer, the global lock layer. That's part of the file system. It's the interface between the actual directory, the file system operations like makedir and create and all that. And it's the interface between that and then the locking modules that plug in. So it handles things. Lock caching is one of them. So the idea is that if we just use the lock, we'll probably use it again pretty soon. So we hold on to it. And that means we don't have to go through the overhead of acquiring the lock again. And the glock layer takes care of that. Then there are locking modules. So there may be multiple different ways of locking. There's the memory export and glock that I talked about. I also talked about Stephen Tweedy's working on a Linux cluster infrastructure and distributed lock manager that may be something somebody else wants to use. And there are basically a bunch of different ways of different locking you might want to do. So we have this lock module interface that lets you plug in different ways of doing locking. So I have a picture of this. A user space program would call down, do a system call, and that would reach the virtual file system layer. And that would eventually call GFS. To do locking, GFS would either use the glock layer to talk to, say, the IP lock module. We have a non-redundant lock module that just runs in IP and does TCP. And it might talk out, it'll talk to the IP lock module, and that module will talk out over the network to acquire the lock. Or if we were doing DLock or the memory export, the glock layer talks to the other module, and that DLock layer will talk to pool, and pool will shuffle off the lock command to one of the disks. The other thing that DLock does is, if you're holding a lock for a very long period of time and somebody else wants it, you need to know that somebody else wants it. So there are these callbacks between machines. So when you're holding a lock and somebody else wants it, they send you a message saying, hey, release this lock. And DLock also talks over IP to do that. So the GLock layer also allows recursive locking. So basically, won't go into this all this much. Basically, you can acquire a lock multiple times as long as you unlock it multiple times. It handles buffer cache invalidation, like I was talking about. Before the GLock layer releases a lock, it is the one that goes down that list, syncing buffers or invalidating buffers. It also syncs transactions, now that we're a journal file system, and it keeps inodes up to date. I'll try and be real brief with this code stuff. I know most of you probably don't want to see code. The main part to look at here is this get GL struct. Is GFS, the lock names are basically numbers. So there's a 64-bit lock number that describes what you're locking, and then there's also a type. So you can say you want a metadata lock, or flock is a file lock, so we support that. And you pass that into this structure, or this function, and you get back this GLock structure, which is what most of the locking code understands. So you get this lock structure passed back and forth. And so when you want to acquire a lock, you pass in that GLock structure with a bunch of flags. The GL share tells you whether you want the lock shared, or GL try tells you, I just want to try and get the lock, give up if you can't get it. And a couple other ones for recovery. So you get back a zero if you required the lock, and then you can go ahead and do your metadata operation. So if you have a lock, you have to have an unlock. So you just pass in that same GLock structure to release the lock. So a simple example of just how this would work. Suppose we're doing a write. Part of the write would be you acquire the lock on that inode, then you can do all your block mapping routines and do your write, and then afterwards you unlock the lock. And because lock caching is happening, the lock may not actually be released out to the network yet. That lock is cached. And as long as that lock is actually held by the machine and cached, you can do write-back caching on that data that you just wrote. So it can stay dirty in the buffer cache, and maybe the next write that you do will add to that or change it again. So basically it lets us do write caching. And so that's a simple example of how we do writes. This is a actually kind of complicated example. One thing about if you have one lock per file, if you think about rename or makedir or something, it deals with multiple files. So one thing that we have to do is acquire multiple locks for each transaction. And basically you have to overlap locks. So basically, you have to overlap them so that something bad doesn't happen during the point where you release the first lock and acquire the second. So you need to acquire the first lock, acquire the second lock, acquire the third lock, and then do your work and then release them. And the problem with that is it gives you deadlock. So, or it gives you the potential for deadlock. So if, I'll show you a picture. If you have this directory tree, one machine is holding the lock for A and is trying to get the lock for B, and one machine has X and is trying to get Y, but the locks for these files map to these numbers that are up there. They can be trying to acquire the numbers in opposite order, and they can deadlock. So we have to deal with a way of making sure that this deadlock doesn't happen. We've gone through multiple ways of doing it. We did back off and retry for a while. So we grabbed the first lock, and then we tried to acquire the second lock. And if we weren't able to get it in a certain period of time, we thought, oh, well, deadlock must be happening. So we back off for a while, wait for a while, and then retry it again. And this wasn't all that great because you can get false retries just because of a highly loaded system. What we're doing right now is sorting lock numbers. So you make sure you always acquire the locks in ascending order, and that gives you a way of acquiring them in a deadlock-free way. So this picture here is, if you're looking at it, you would think that you wouldn't have to do have to worry because they're separate directories. So that get going X and Y shouldn't interfere with A and B. And the reason they did, or they did when we first started GFS, is because we had our lock space was simple. You had, say, N locks, and they were numbered 0 through N minus 1. And if you had more inodes than that, you could map multiple inodes to the same locks. And this caused this big headache here, so that you had to do a lot of work to make sure you didn't get deadlocked. Our new locking scheme is a sparse lock space. So basically, locks have arbitrary names, and you can acquire as many locks as you want. And the device has a certain number of locks, so it still has 0 through n minus 1 locks. But their names aren't given to you. You're given a pointer to a certain name. So basically what you can do is, it looks like you have that many locks. It looks like you have 2 to the 64th locks. But you can only use a certain number of them at a certain time, or at a given time. And it'll tell you when you're using too many of them. So it does mapping locks for you. So basically, what I'm trying to say is that now each file has its own lock. And now that we have this one-to-one mapping of locks, it basically gives us, it makes locking a lot simpler. So write caching. GFS can't have dirty cache data after the lock is released. So like I was saying earlier, you have the process that drops a lock has to go through that list and sync out all the dirty data. Like I was saying before, locks, we used to be very synchronous, so we didn't do caching at all, and we used to acquire and release locks each operation, but that made things very slow. Now that locks are held for a longer period of time, we can do caching is much more useful. Glocks have three states, basically. There's a not held state where the machine doesn't hold the lock and it doesn't have any data for that lock, or if there is data for the lock, it's not dirty, and the machine isn't counting on that data. So the next state is held. So held means the machine itself is holding this shared lock, but no process is currently using it. So basically, there can be dirty data for that lock. So remember in the write example I showed you guys, after that last unlock happened, there was still dirty data in the cache, and the lock was in the held state. So basically that data is cached and the dirty data stays dirty in the buffer cache until the VM system decides it needs to be flushed out. But the thing is that any machine that needs that lock sends a message to that machine and asks it to release the lock. And at that point, the dirty data is flushed out and the lock state is dropped and not held. There is also locked. So locked is held, but a process is using it. So there can be dirty data for the lock, and the lock won't be released until the process is through using it. Okay, a callback picture. So suppose client 1 has a lock that client 2 wants. Client 2 will send a request to the SCSI disk saying, please give me this lock. The SCSI disk will give back a response, result equals 0, meaning you didn't get the lock. It'll tell you there's one holder of the lock, and his name is this client ID, this number. Client 2 can then use that number to send a callback to the first client saying, please drop this lock. Client 1 will finish doing whatever it's doing, sync back the data, and then release the lock by telling the SCSI disk, please unlock this lock. Meanwhile, client 2 is polling the SCSI disk, and when it finally sees the lock is unlocked, it can acquire the lock and go on and do whatever it was going to do. So this callback is out of bounds, or it's not defined in SCSI. Basically, SCSI drives your talk to, and drives never talk back, or they only talk when they only speak when they're spoken to. So drives can't send this callback to the client. So we have to do this out of bounds IP method of doing callbacks. Sure.
Why
Yes, they're reader-writer locks. So there can be one exclusive writer or many readers. Yes. Okay. It's totally possible. It's not the second that client one or client two sits there and waits for that callback, then you have a problem with what happens if client one dies and it sits there waiting forever. So it's possible to have client one send a courtesy callback that says try now, but if client two depends on that lock, then you have lots of problems, and it's just much simpler to do it this way, to have it full. Okay, I don't know how much I'll go into this. Basically, one of the things about Unix is that you can unlink a file, and even though it's not linked into the file system, anybody who had that file open can read and write from that file. So compilers do this a lot. They do temp files. They create a temp file, they open it, they unlink it, and then they continue and read and write from it. And you don't have to worry about it being linked into the file system. Or you don't have to worry about name clashes. It's, I guess, the big thing that you can have multiple files that you don't have to worry about two compilers coming up with the same name as much. So GFS, we want to do this in GFS so that multiple processes on multiple machines can have this file open, and the last one to close the file after it's been unlinked is the one that erases the file. So earlier we had our solution to this was to keep a count in the inode. So on disk there was a count. Every time you read in an inode, you incremented this count, and then when you closed the inode, you decremented the count. And if you were the one that decremented the count to zero, in the number of links, the link count in the file system is also zero. You're the one that deallocates it. And this kind of works, but it's kind of slow. To just do a read-only file system, you're still doing writes to change this count. So it was kind of slow. So we replaced it with a lock. I guess I should have said, one of the driving forces of GFS is this locking. And as our locking has gotten better and better, our features get better and better. And now that we have sparse locks, we can have one lock or many locks per inode, and one of those locks can be held in a shared state. And you know when everybody's through working on that inode because you can acquire that lock exclusively and nobody else is holding it. Okay, a bit about interchangeable locking modules. So you can plug in multiple lock modules. I guess I've talked about all this. More code that I'll try and keep simple. The lock protocols register themselves with GFS. There's a mount operation. You give it the name of the lock space you want to mount. You give it the callback that the lock module sends a callback to GFS saying, please release these locks. It also returns, there are multiple journals in GFS. It tells you, the lock module tells you what journal to mount. And then there's an unmount as well. So there's get lock, which is an analog of the get GL struct I told you about earlier. You give it a lock number and a type, and it gives you back the structure that is kind of like the token you pass around whenever you talk about that lock. You can acquire the lock operation. You acquire a lock. You can ask for it in a shared lock or an exclusive lock, or you can move between the two. You can promote from shared to exclusive, or you can demote back down. Again, some of the same flags I told you about before, just in this new layer. You can try. There's no expire, which is what no X stands for, which is, like I was talking about earlier with the D-locks, basically locks expire. You heartbeat the drives, and as long as you're heartbeating the drives, you own any of the locks that you've acquired. As soon as you stop heartbeating the drive, it recognizes this, and all the locks you were holding become expired. And what expired does is it forms a fence between the good part of the file system that machine wasn't messing with and the part of the file system that could be inconsistent because that machine had cached data that it was working on when it died. So after a machine dies, there's a good part of the file system and a bad part of the file system. The expired flags on the locks become a fence between the two. And so a normal I/O process that hits an expired lock sits there and waits until the lock becomes unexpired. And while it's sitting there and waiting, it tells an upper layer saying, hey, somebody died. We need to wake up a recovery thread that will take care of the damage that this guy did when he died. So basically, one of the recovery operations is, part of that recovery is you don't want to do that. You want to ignore the fact that that locks are expired. So NOAA tells you to ignore the fact that a lock is expired. Recovery is another thing. Basically, when you're replaying the journal, you don't have to mess with locks that aren't expired because you know the machine wasn't holding them when it died. Only the locks that the machine was holding are expired. And you get back a bunch of flags. And then there's unlock. Just unlock a lock. Cancel, so you might want to, or during recovery, it's possible that a normal I/O process is stuck waiting for a lock. You want the recovery process to take priority and jump in front of the normal I/O process so that it can do recovery. So cancel lets the recovery process cancel a normal I/O process so that the recovery can jump ahead. There's reset, I won't talk about that. Stomath, shoot the other machine in the head. One of the really big problems, or it's not very complicated, but it's a problem for shared disk file systems, is what happens in some error cases. So what Stomath does is what's called I/O fencing. So you have this problem here where suppose you have a cluster of machines that are all running, and you have a kernel debugger on one of the machines. Somebody sets a breakpoint, and that kernel debugger goes off and dumps into the debugger. So you have your machine that all of a sudden becomes frozen. It stops heart beating its drives, and those drives eventually say, hey, this guy's dead. The other machines in the cluster go back and they recover for that machine. They replay its journal, they reset all its expired locks, and they start working on that file system as well, or those locks. So it can start holding locks that debugger machine used to hold. Now, if somebody types go in that kernel debugger again, that machine wakes up. And it wakes up thinking it was holding all the locks that it held when it first went to sleep. So you end up having two machines, or more than two machines, that think they're holding the same lock at the same time, exclusively. They think they're the only writer on this lock, or on this data. So basically, they both start writing over the same data, and you corrupt your file system very quickly. So the idea with Stomath is that you, before you do any recovery, you make sure he's dead. You forcibly kill his power. You tell the drives, don't talk to this guy. Or there are many different methods of doing this. And what the Stomath operation does is it calls down to the lock module, and the lock module does uses whatever. There's a configuration tool that lets you pick what method of Stomath to do for a particular client. So it tells the lock module, do this Stomath method. So the machine dies, and you can safely do recovery. So reset expired, so like I was saying, locks expire. Reset expired, after you've done all your recovery, you call reset expired and that resets the locks. So callback, talked a lot about this. Basically lets a machine know that another machine needs a lock, or it lets GFS know that a machine has died and it needs it to recovery. So we've done a bunch of different protocols. So no lock is this dummy lock that I was talking about that lets you do local file systems. We have a bunch of different versions of DLock. We're working on a memory export, which will be our new thing. We have a non-redundant IP lock server. So if you want to if you go to globalfilesystem.org, you can download the code. There's a program you run on one machine, you stick it in the corner, and all the other machines in your cluster can talk to that machine to get locks. And it's a very good way to start working with GFS. And the goal is that eventually we'll work failover and things like that into that lock server so that if that machine in the corner dies, your whole cluster doesn't stall. We're also looking for a DLM. So like I said, Stephen Tweedy was working on DLM. Just on one of the mailing lists, somebody kind of gave us a DLM. We're still trying to figure out how usable that is. The guy working at Cornell is working on a C-Assemble, or Ensemble, DLM. So all those things probably be happening in the future. Bit about namespaces, the lock module. So we've been talking about these callbacks and things. There's a big configuration problem here. For each machine, there's a journal number, what journal to mount, the IP address to talk to them, how to do Stonewith and things like that. So GFS doesn't know about any of these things. The lock module's in charge of it. And there are multiple ways of configuring this stuff. For like the IP lock server, the server can be the configuration file. For DLock or memory export, there's a special shared pool that contains this configuration information. And for DLM, we'll have its, and the cluster infrastructure will have its own method of doing this. So the important part is that the lock module is in charge of the configuration. So a bit about recovery. So a file system check is the classic means of doing recovery. It's slow. Everybody knows its problems. The one big problem about for GFS is that you can't do it online. You have to have all the machines off of the file system in order to do it. So you don't want to have to shut down all 20 of your machines just because one crashed and you need to do a file system check. So we've been doing journaling to solve this problem. The recovery time is fast, and it lets us do recovery online. So when one machine dies, the others can look at its journal and replay the journal, and the cluster can get going again in a couple seconds. Having multiple journals is really complex, or having a single journal is very complex. You don't want to have the machines share this journal. It becomes very quickly a bottleneck. So each machine gets its own journal. So the journal is protected by one lock that you acquire when you mount, and when you unmount, you unlock that lock. So it's very simple locking. I'll show you a picture. So we have this file system. It has four journals. You can kind of control where the journals go so that you can optimize your layout for performance. So you have a bunch of journals, and you have a bunch of resource groups that have all your data in them. One of the differences between GFS and a normal journaling file system is that there are these global locks, these GLocks that are associated with each transaction. So if you think about a create, you have the directory you're creating in, the bitmaps you allocate the new inode from, and the new inode. And each one of these has a lock. And the locks have certain buffers that you change associated with it. So the big trick for journaling for GFS is that you want to make the latency of these callbacks very quick, or as small as possible. So suppose you have a bunch of things in your journal that are in your in-core journal waiting to get committed to the disk. You want to make sure, if you get a callback, you want to have to sync out as little as possible of that in-core journal to the disk before you can release a lock. If you had to sync right out the whole journal every time you got a callback, there'd be a lot of overhead. You wouldn't get good performance. So by associating this data with the locks and associating the locks with the transactions, we can pick which in-core transactions we want to sync out. And that lets us have to write less data out. About multiple journal entries are cached in-core. So you do a bunch of transactions, and once you've done all those transactions, you write out a big transaction to the disk. So basically what this means is you're doing write caching for transactions. And it makes things very fast, and you have not very good performance if you don't have it. So like I was talking about the one exception basically is directories. If you move a directory from one directory to another directory, and you aren't, if you don't strictly serialize those, you can end up getting directory loops, where basically you get a part of the directory structure that's not attached to the root, and it's basically bad. So directories are synchronized in strict order. Also, I have an example of this. You create file X in directory Y, or directory A. You modify data corresponding to the three locks. If you do B, if you create Y and B, you modify data corresponding to other locks. Those first two operations you can reorder any way you want because they have no locks in common. If you do this third one, it has locks that overlap with both of them. When this third one is committed, it will get combined with the other two. So a callback on, say, resource group 11, at that point would sync out all three. But if rename hadn't been committed, you would only have to sync out the create BY. So when you get a callback, you have to push out any transactions that correspond to that lock. So like I was talking about expiration, when a machine dies, there's expiration. I guess I talked about all this. Okay, So recovery initial or initiation. So when a machine first mounts, it checks its journal to make sure that it's clean. You also check the journal when you get a call back saying this guy died. Piece of metadata. You check to make sure that the generation number you're about to write over is smaller than the one that you are going to write, so that you're allowed to write that piece of metadata, and you just go through the journal replaying this metadata. And then when you're done, you mark the journal as recovered, you reset the expired locks, and then you can release that journal lock. So the neat thing about generation numbers is they let you replay journals independently. So if you have a 10-machine cluster and three of the machines die because a janitor trips over the power cords or something, and all three of them die at once, you don't have to, the other machines that are still up don't have to coordinate really to replay that journal, those three journals. Each machine picks a different journal, and they replay the journal without talking to any others other than doing standard locking. So the nice thing is locks can be replayed independently. And the other nice thing is that machines that are doing work in portions of the file system that weren't being used by that guy that just died, those machines can keep on working and doing whatever they want. You only need to stop if you want data that was being used by the guy that just died. Let me skip over some performance. I'll talk about this separately if people want. Talk quick about some Linux issues. So some of the things that we need to work out with Linux is basically there's talk about doing metadata through the page cache. I guess Steve Lord from SGI is going to talk about that tomorrow, so we're looking forward to that. There's still some dcache and VFS issues that we need to work out. The dcache does a lot of checking for us when it probably shouldn't be, because it's doing checks on data that's actually stale. And there's also some cache coherent memory mapping. If you want to make things totally transparent between machines, you need to make it so that when two machines memory map the same file, they see a coherent picture. And that's not happening right now. Although if they do reads and writes, they see a coherent picture. Oh, and the other thing that's not up there is there's still a lot of work that needs to be done to make x86 Linux 64-bit compatible. And that's something we're working on. So current state, so journaling distributed recovery we have implemented. We're working really hard to get our first really big release out this summer. Mostly what we have to do left is this new memory export locking protocol that we've just gotten. We're trying to get that in order. We need to do lots of testing. We're working on making it so we do locking that's really fine-grained. Each block in the file system gets its own lock, and you can have very sharing of a file. One thing that we're working on for our next release is growable file systems. So that's one of the other things that we're waiting on is basically we want people to be able to add disks to their file system while it's online and working. And so a big data center that doesn't want to take down its file system, just add more disks, and we're working on that. A longer range snapshotting, so basically we want to be able to take snapshots of the file system. So you quickly freeze the file system, you take an image of the file system, you don't copy all the data, but just enough data you need to have a consistent picture of what the file system was at a given time. And then later on, as you keep on going, you do copy on writes. So the idea is you do a snapshot, and then you can do a backup off that snapshot, and you have a consistent backup. And we're working on doing that. Scalability, we'll keep on adding machines, try and see how many machines we can add. We don't know how far that'll go. We need to do application level testing. So one of the things that people are really looking forward to in GFS is web server clusters and NFS clusters. And we need to do more testing and performance measurements and stuff like that. And then we're going to do ports to other operating systems. So FreeBSD and the other BSDs will probably be our first one. So I guess that's about my time. Any questions? Great.
Was there any real big test implementation done already? Did you try this in a test environment with a lot of computers, or is that still
Well, I guess what I was running short on time, so I skipped it. The performances, VA Research lends us the 16-way Racket machines, and Brocade and Seagate and Fibre Channel gave us all these disks and switches and stuff. So we've done 16-way testing that's worked. We're on the process of making it bigger. Other questions? Okay.
Yes, I have one question regarding the recovery. You check the generation number on this before you actually commit the journal, but how can the generation number on this be higher than the one you want to write because you are supposed to have a log for the inode? Aren't you?
It's a complicated case where the active portion of a log can the piece of data can be in the active portion of the log even though you've released the lock. So it's possible for a block to be in the log and another machine had to have gotten that lock and made modifications. So I can explain it more in detail. It's kind of complicated.
Okay.
But it's possible to happen, and if that machine dies, you don't know that it released the lock and somebody else had used it. And then generation numbers are how you know that. Other questions? Okay, thanks for listening.